From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
Every day we are warned by our government of the threat of a biological weapons being used here, in particular anthrax. I think it would thus come as a shock to most Americans to realize that in the 1980s, the U.S. government sent to our arch enemy now, Iraq, a whole slew of biological weapons.
Today, anthrax for export, and we'll look at the U.S. biological weapons from Plum Island to Ames, Iowa. Also, whistleblowers warn the U.S. is vulnerable to nuclear attack, not from abroad, but from our own weapons facilities. And a UCLA librarian is suspended without pay for sending an email critical of U.S. foreign policy. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from what used to be Ground Zero alone. Now Ground Zero is also Afghanistan. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. planes unleash their biggest raid to date on Afghanistan, triggering fresh accusations from the ruling Taliban of civilian deaths, 15 of them in a mosque. The U.S. hit the southern Afghan city of Kandahar early today, the latest of a series of U.S.-led raids that have sent civilians fleeing for the Pakistani border. Afghanistan's ruling Taliban militia say 18 people were killed and more than two dozen hurt. 10 other people were killed in strikes early Thursday on the eastern city of Jalalabad. This, according to the Taliban, and neighboring Pakistan, government officials confirm for the first time that U.S. personnel have arrived on the ground and that the Americans have been granted use of several Pakistani air bases. At the border crossing into Pakistan that is closest to Kandahar, refugees reported the strikes were escalating. Ekhtiar Mohammed, a brickworker who arrived in the border town of Chaman yesterday, said he'd seen at least 10 people killed and 30 injured in Kandahar over the past 4 days. Another arriving refugee said some bombs in recent days had been hitting populated areas, even though the U.S. military pledged not to target civilians. And in Washington, officials say troop-carrying and attack helicopters with U.S. troops would soon join the campaign against the Taliban regime. At U.S. request, networks agree to edit future bin Laden tapes. The five major television news organizations reached a joint agreement yesterday to follow the suggestion of the White House and abridge any future videotape statements from Osama bin Laden or his followers to remove language the government considers inflammatory. The decision is the first time in memory that the networks had agreed to a joint arrangement to limit their prospective news coverage. It was described by one network executive as a patriotic decision that grew out of a conference call between the nation's top television news executives and the White House National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice yesterday morning. The executives said they would broadcast only short parts of any tape issued by al-Qaeda and would eliminate any passages containing flowery rhetoric urging violence against Americans. They agreed to accompany the tapes with reports providing what they call appropriate context. White House move coincides with a clampdown on the release of information about the war effort. The Pentagon Wednesday stopped its daily briefings with reporters, reducing the sessions to twice a week. And a third publishing company employee in Boca Raton, Florida, tested positive for exposure to anthrax, which has already killed one man. And the probe into the infection is now a criminal investigation. Investigators have been looking into the source of anthrax bacteria at the offices of the American Media, Inc. publishing company. Robert Stevens, a 63-year-old photo editor for the American Media's Sun tabloid, died on Friday of anthrax. Mailroom employee Ernesto Blanco is hospitalized after testing positive for exposure to anthrax, and traces of the bacteria were found on the computer keyboard used by the dead man. Now a 35-year-old woman has tested positive for anthrax. Under pressure from Congress, President Bush agreed today to restore access to classified briefings to a wider legislative audience after lawmakers balked at Bush's initial effort to limit such information to just 8 senior leaders. Administration and congressional officials said Bush agreed the secretaries of state and defense could continue to provide classified briefings to members of the Armed Services and Foreign Relations Committees and even the full membership. Bush had tried to limit briefings to the leaders of both houses and the chairman and ranking members of the intelligence committees. And Saudi Arabia is refusing to freeze the assets of Osama bin Laden and his associates. This, according to Bush administration officials, the failure of a critical ally in the Muslim world to address the major concerns of Washington has put the relationship under increasing pressure. In addition, some of the princes in the extended royal family are believed to have connections to charities. That leaves the United States strongly allied with a powerful Islamic country that refuses to cut bin Laden's financial lifeline. And hate crimes against Arabs, Muslims reach an unprecedented level. The Council on American Islamic Relations, a Washington-based organization, said they've collected reports of more than 700 hate crimes across the U.S. since September 11th. Federal officials said they're investigating at least 120 incidents. And thousands of Muslim students and activists took to the streets of 8 Indonesian cities yesterday, the fourth day of protests against U.S.-led airstrikes in Afghanistan.
Ben, let me respond to that. Hello, Ben, are you there?
Let's take a call from Montreal. It's Joe, you're on the air.
Yeah, tell me what's the use of PhDs for ICBMs if your politics are throwbacks to the Roman Colosseum. And when you leave the study just to seek a little heat, how you gonna tell a good guy from a villain? It turns out your education was so vague and incomplete that you can't even tell anthrax from penicillin.
Are they so clever?
They're not so clever. Just ask the population of Sudan. The smartest bomb of all would never even fall, would stay up in the air like Peter Pan.
I won't blow up.
Well, okay, Mr. MX, with your staggering IQ, why don't you tell us what you'd do if you only had your choice?
Well, I'd bubba-buddel, Greg, takamina, ron, con, bron, toneron, tuon, fun. That wasn't an explosion. I was quoting from James Joyce.
Smart Bombs from the CD The Prince Mishkin's Shiny Round Object here on the War and Peace Report from Ground Zero Radio. This is Democracy Now in Exile. I'm Amy Goodman. A third person has tested positive for anthrax, and the case has become the subject of a criminal investigation. The bacteria has already killed one man, put a co-worker in the hospital. Now a 35-year-old woman has tested positive. Meanwhile, unnamed sources close to the FBI yesterday said the unusual characteristics of the particular anthrax bacteria that killed the man in Florida suggests it was produced in a laboratory and that it may have been produced at an unnamed lab in Iowa. The Centers for Disease Control has said it has virtually ruled out environmental causes as the source. We're joined now by two people. John McDonald is a news reporter who has written on Plum Island, which is a viral research facility and is off of the coast of Long Island. Bill Blum is also on the line with us. William Blum is former State Department official and author of Killing Hope, CIA Interventions Since World War II. He also did a piece for the Progressive magazine called Anthrax for Export. We welcome you both to the War and Peace Report. Let's start with Bill Blum. Anthrax is the story of the day, with three people now coming down with it in the same media compound in Boca Raton, Florida. You've written about anthrax, but in this case, anthrax being exported. Can you talk about what you found?
Yeah, in the 1980s, while Iran and Iraq were at war with each other, the U.S. government approved the export of a number of biological materials to Iraq, plus the equipment needed to produce actual biological weapons. apparently in the hope that Iraq would use them against Iran. While that war was going on, the U.S. government was supplying both sides with military aid and intelligence information. And so I can only assume that the intention was to maximize the damage that the two of them would do to each other. And they sent to Iraq the Bacillus anthracis, which is the cause of anthrax, the E. coli bacterium, and other bacteria which cause very serious ailments, plus, as I mentioned, the equipment. And this came out in a Senate report in 1994, which pointed out that these materials had not been in any way attenuated or weakened and were capable of reproduction. And it was later learned, the committee said, that these microorganisms exported by the U.S. were identical to those the United Nations inspectors found and removed from the Iraqi biological warfare program.
Bill Bloom on the line with us. His piece appeared in the Progressive called Anthrax for Export. You quote Noam Chomsky suggesting that the strategy of arming Iraq and also arming Iran was a way for America to keep control of its oil supply. You also talk about the U.S. companies that actually provided the most biological materials, American Type Culture Collection of Maryland, Virginia. What is this company?
They made 70 shipments of the anthrax-causing germ and other pathogenic agents to Iraq. That is not their main business, of course, but that's... I don't know, I forget actually what they... what their main purpose as a business is. This is what they did in the 1980s with the full approval of the U.S. Commerce Department.
What about the other companies that make chemical and biological materials that were named in Senate hearings?
Well, there's a long list of them. Some of them is, there's one called Alcolac International of Baltimore. There's the Newcraft Mercantile Corporation of Brooklyn, the Celery Corporation of Charlotte, North Carolina, the Matrix Churchill Corporation of Cleveland, which was regarded as a front for the Iraqi government, according to one congressman. Let's see what else there is.
You also noted that the Bechtel group in San Francisco was sued, is that right, in connection with their activities providing Iraq with chemical or biological supplies?
You know, I'm looking at the article which I wrote a few years ago, and I don't remember what I said now.
Well, I've got it in front of me.
Yeah,
and that's
okay.
What you
why don't you read
it?
That I can't find it.
But we're also joined by John McDonald. He used to write for Newsday. He's now a reporter at the Orange County Register in California. You've written extensively about Plum Island. In our next hour, we're going to talk with two scientists specifically about anthrax. But I wanted to talk about these major facilities that produce bioweapons. Can you talk about Plum Island and its past?
Yes. Plum Island is the U.S. Agriculture Department's Foreign Disease Research Center. And its counterpart for domestic diseases, animal diseases, is in Ames, Iowa. Anthrax, as you may or may not know, is actually a domestic disease. It occurs naturally in the United States and primarily is a danger to cattle, cattle being one of the biggest industries in the United States. They don't openly at least produce biological weapons. Plum Island, I do know from documents I discovered, although it was denied for 40 years, documents I discovered in the early 90s, showed that, in fact, the facility had originally been constructed by the Army Chemical Corps as part of an offensive biological warfare plan targeting the Soviet Union. Offensive biological warfare research in the United States was banned by President Nixon in 1969, and the continuation of defensive biological warfare research has been permitted, and also the reality is that infectious disease research is virtually the same as any sort of biological warfare research. What you do is you create new strains of viruses, and you then try to find vaccines against them, and when you have a strain for which you have a vaccine and the other side doesn't, you then have a viable biological warfare weapon. In infectious disease research, I mean, you're constantly trying to find new strains and vaccines to them so that if that strain does infect cattle or people, you can then use the vaccine to protect populations against that illness. They do use incredible safety procedures at these facilities. They're not so incredible. I first came to Plum Island after a hurricane when they knocked power out for like 18 hours, and one of the principal protections is a negative air system, whereby anytime there's a breach in containment, air flows in instead of out so that you don't get germs going into the atmosphere. That didn't work for 18 hours. But when you go into these facilities, you literally have to take off all of your clothes. You wear lab clothes while you're inside. When you leave, you have to, what they call, shower out. You take off the lab clothes, you shower, you wash your hair, you blow your nose, you gargle, you have to clean your fingernails, and then you go out to put on your street clothes. Our photographers would have to bring in underwater cameras so that they could put them into solutions that would kill any sort of microorganisms that they collected on them. I would take notes while interviewing people, and they would have to fax the notes to me because I couldn't leave with the pages. That's some of the things. Now, I don't know that this anthrax came from Ames, Iowa, but I would suspect that that's a possible source because I believe they do anthrax research at Ames, Iowa.
We're talking to John McDonald. He's an Orange County Register reporter who has researched Plum Island, its shadowy past. Once secret documents, lab's mission was germ warfare. New York was dealing with West Nile virus for a while and continues to, and there was some speculation. Some thought perhaps did it actually come from experiments at Plum Island, since Plum Island operates today. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't discount the possibility. I know that that disease is carried by mosquitoes. There are incredible numbers of mosquitoes in the Long Island area, and the wind can blow them virtually anywhere. They do take precautions to, you know, keep these diseases from getting outside the laboratory. They do research, I know, on Rift Valley fever, which is from that same area. It's possible there have been, but then again, rumors constantly percolate around that facility. It's believed that Lyme disease comes from Plum Island by some, but the reality is there's no indication that they do bacteriological research on the island. They strictly do viral research, which would seem to discount Lyme disease. It's also been, and perhaps even, you know, that AIDS may have come from Plum Island. There had been some belief early during the AIDS epidemic that it was related somehow to African swine fever, which is a fever, which is a disease which is studied on Plum Island. It's rampant in places like Uganda and Haiti, which are the same places that AIDS came from or were first detected. The Harvard School of Public Medicine had wanted to do some research, and you can't bring the, you know, African swine fever and diseases like that onto the continental United States. You have to keep them on Plum Island, and the CCD wouldn't let basically, or the Agriculture Department, the government would not let Harvard do any research on that disease on Plum Island, and some have suspected that that's because of competition between CCD and Harvard in their AIDS research. But there, I mean, there does, you know, virtually any kind of exotic disease could come from Plum Island if it's studied there, because despite the containment and all the security precautions, it's hard to keep these things in. They can get out.
And to be clear, Plum Island is involved with offensive bioweapons research.
Well, I mean, they were involved in the 1950s in offensive biological warfare research. Documents show that conclusively.
Germ warfare.
And one of the things they did was they went to virtually the entire world and they collected dozens of exotic viruses that were potential biological warfare agents. And they brought them to the island. Each individual disease has numerous strains, all of which need a different kind of a vaccine. They brought in scores of strains, all for development. Interestingly, the primary diseases they were looking at, which included African swine fever and foot and mouth disease, they continued to do research. They continue to this day to be that is their primary area of research, the same ones that were considered as biological warfare agents.
And in terms of sites in the United States, you're talking about Plum Island off of Long Island.
Right.
The anthrax story that's taking place now in Boca Raton with a third person now testing positive for anthrax, they're saying that possibly came from a lab in Ames, Iowa. What are these sites around the country?
Well, I mean, Fort Detrick is the one that does the primary research on germ warfare defense. I believe there's some research going on in Provo, Utah, and Ames, Iowa it's involved in disease research, and publicly, it has no connection with any sort of biological warfare research. I know Plum Island had the same stance that they were involved in animal disease research, but while I was covering that part of New York, I came across things like visits to the island by members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and people who were involved in the negotiations with the Geneva Protocol. And actually, I did manage to attend. I was sneaked onto the island by a friendly source during an on-site inspection by a biological warfare inspection team from the from Russia in 1994. This dividing line between infectious disease research and biological warfare research is a very, very thin line, a very subtle line that would be very hard for most people to detect.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, John McDonald, with the Orange County Register, a reporter who's written extensively about Plum Island, a viral research facility that was involved with offensive germ warfare and continues to do research to this day. In our second hour in this two-hour War and Peace Report special that we've been doing for the last weeks, this is the month anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. In our second hour, we'll be talking about the top secret U.S. government experiments performed in the United States that involved anthrax and other biological weapons with a professor at MIT as well as an author who wrote the book The 11th Plague. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we move from bioweapons to nuclear weapons, the threat at home. Stay with us.
Four bright weapons have in common is a problem. I don't mean the confusion over last year's Nobel Prize. It's tragic and it's farcical how the world's smartest arsenal always seems to fall for all the wrong guys. They've tried the 12-step programs, the self-help manuals. They've analyzed all the annuals we can keep on the shelves. So what is this pathology that makes our best technology go loco for politicos much dumber than themselves? Is there a solution? The bombs want your opinion. Please call in and talk to us. We need to hear your voices. Let's go to the phones. This is the topic of our show tonight. Smart bombs, foolish choices.
Smart bombs from the Prince Mishkin's Shiny Round Object. Here on the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. Our next hour, we will also look at the bioweapons protocol and how the Bush administration walked away from the table this summer in developing a protocol for bioweapons because U.S. drug companies didn't want to reveal their secrets. But right now, we are going to take a look at the nuclear threat, not from abroad, but here at home. When 19 men hijacked planes and flew them into the World Trade Center and Pentagon in the first major attack on the continental U.S., a terrifying new tactic was born. People who don't have the resources to launch a traditional military attack on the U.S. instead used U.S. technological, economic, and military strength against its own civilian population. Bioweapons may pose a similar threat. Early reports have emerged that the anthrax strain, which has already killed one person, may have well been developed in a lab in Iowa. It was the U.S. that perfected anthrax as a bioweapon in the 50s and 60s. And now the Project on Government Oversight is warning that the Federal Department of Energy's nuclear weapons labs and production facilities are highly vulnerable to attack. According to a new report, the plutonium and uranium sites have consistently failed mock security tests and leave metropolitan regions like the Bay Area in California and Denver vulnerable to a nuclear detonation that would dwarf the impacts of Chernobyl. In one of the worst illustrations of security breaches, Navy SEALs were able to make a big enough hole in a chain-link fence surrounding Rocky Flats nuclear production facility that in Colorado that they were able to steal enough plutonium for several bombs. In another, Army commandos walked out of the University of California-managed Los Alamos National Lab in New Mexico with a Home Depot garden cart filled with nuclear material. The report was initiated when more than one dozen whistleblowers contacted the group with unclassified material highlighting their concerns. One of them, Ronald Tim, was the lead analyst for the Department of Energy's Office of Safeguards and Security. He says the DOE repeatedly ignored his warnings and speculates it's because contractors are paid a substantial bonus if they receive good security ratings. We're going to go to Ronald Tim in a moment, but first we're joined by Danielle Bryan, who's executive director of the Project on Government Oversight. Can you summarize what the report says?
Yes, Amy, we actually had sort of eerie timing. We've been working on this investigation for 8 months, and we're preparing to release the report at the time of the attacks. Essentially, what we learned is that the Department of Energy's weapons facilities, which were created at the time, you know, 50 years ago, were essentially placed in unpopulated areas which wouldn't have much impact on surrounding communities. But since, you know, it's 50 years later, Denver has been has built up around Rocky Flats, as you mentioned, Lawrence Livermore, Albuquerque is another city which has the bomb complex right in the center of their communities. And they maintain enormous levels of plutonium and weapons-grade uranium. And the security systems are tested by mock attacks where terrorists, in quotations, are played by Army commandos. And what we found from our sources, our whistleblowers, is that more than half the time the terrorists are successful in getting in and either creating a sabotage which would spread radiation or worse, or create an actual detonation or take the materials out so that they could create a bomb somewhere else.
Ronald Tim, you've been trying to make this known to the U.S. government and the Department of Energy. Can you explain why you became a whistleblower?
Out of sheer frustration as both a professional and an ethical choice, when we are asked to do this, we are asked to protect the public. This is a societal target, and it's not my decision to do this. This comes down as presidential directives as well as departmental directives. And so they have set the standard, and they said, we're willing to accept this much risk, and we're not willing to accept additional risk. And when we consistently exceeded the level that they're prepared to accept, we just said, you know, what's wrong with this picture? And it was not just myself. As a whistleblower, we came forward as a corporation, but we also, our team consisted of people from the Defense Department, people from Sandia National Laboratories in the study groups, ourselves, Department of Energy people. So it was a summary work that was checked and cross-checked by over 20 people across at least three different kinds of modeling, as well as the force on force test that Danielle was talking about. So, you know, that's basically what our role is to bring that forward.
Can you tell us what you found?
Yes, that they were at high risk. The department has a very special way of categorizing things. They call it low risk or high risk, and how you determine that is classified. But once you move into the high risk realm, that is unacceptable as far as the department and the executive is concerned.
Tell us what plants you looked at and what specifically you found.
We actually looked at all 10 plants as well as transportation across the country. What we reported in the Ruth Propogo and working on this was just three of the most blatant examples. It was Rocky Flats, and this example that Danielle gave is an excellent one where they basically came in, and the hole in the fence is just trivial to put in place. You create that in 10 seconds, and we were able to go in, set up fields of fire, basically obliterate the force that's on site, and be gone within 3 to 4 minutes. We had a similar experience at Los
Angeles. So you set up the Navy SEALs?
They had set up their own attack. We had set up a similar attack through a series of different modelings and had run that, and they had independently chose their own method of attack, which happened to be coincidental with what we had, and that's when they won exactly the same way we had simulated they were going to win.
And you were talking about Los Alamos.
Los Alamos was the same thing. They've got, in fact, multiple sites down there that when we ran the scenarios and ran the exercises, Garden Cart was one that when they went in there to do that, they actually told the special forces people that are going to run the test that they had to carry basically a couple hundred pounds of material out on their back, which made the mission almost literally impossible. And they just said, wait a minute, we're not going to lug across, you know, 5 miles of desert these things on our back. So they just went down on their own volition, bought a garden cart at the Home Depot, brought it over as part of their thing, literally that tracks in the snow because it was a wintertime exercise, and dragged it out. And then they cried foul and said, this is an unfair exercise because you weren't supposed to be able to use that cart.
Amy, another example where the management of the facilities would claim a test is unfair, they were blocking the road to access the facility. They put a car sideways and a traffic cone. And when the mock terrorists drove around them, they claimed that was unfair because the terrorists wouldn't have left the road.
Danielle Bryan, Executive Director of the Project on Government Oversight. Ronald Tim, former lead analyst for the Department of Energy's Office of Safeguards and Security. You're talking about all of these different, you know, the Navy SEALs, different people taking the nuclear weapons out.
Yes.
What if someone fired in?
It would be the same thing. We, had, in fact, had Rocky Flats have gone. I was then also doing work for a special assistant to Secretary Richardson. He had set up his own special assistant to find out, you know, am I being given the right information or being snookered? And I happened to be assigned to him also. And we literally walked out the Rocky Flats, and where there was supposed to be a vehicle barrier that would stop you from driving a truck bomb up to alongside a building filled with the mother load of plutonium for Rocky Flats. And I pointed out to him, I said, the vehicle barrier is on the wrong fence. The bad guy will drive right past it, right onto the site, and set off the explosive, and you have a radiological dispersal, and you could stand on a hill and see downtown Denver 15 miles away. And it took the site, once we pointed that out, two years to correct it. And that had been pointed out to him 2 years previously in reports that we had already started generating in January or in March of 1997. And so it was this constant, we don't believe there's a threat, and therefore we're not going to do anything.
Now, explain what would happen exactly if someone fired in a nuclear facility.
Well, if you created a bomb, basically like a truck bomb, if you visualize the Murrah building where they blew up the building there, that was what you would now say that building is filled with plutonium. The blast would uplift, pulverize that material, throw it up into the air, and then it disperses across the city of Denver. Again, the Chernobyl would be another example of that, where you threw it up in the air and just gravitated across the community. What you'd cause is long-term cancer problems with that, rather than immediate death as you would from the explosion itself.
So Denver would have to be evacuated.
Yeah, and you're basically leaving plutonium behind, which is one of the worst actors there are as far as a material and causing cancers.
So you're explaining egregious lapses in security.
Yes.
At these sites. Now, these sites, while they are top sort of secret government facilities. They're run by companies. Is that right? Corporations lease them from the government, like Goodyear?
Right. This particular plant at Rocky Flats is a combination of Kaiser Engineering and CH2M Hill out of Denver. So it's called the Kaiser Hill contract.
And why are these companies so lax in running these facilities?
They're basically given $1. Let's just use the example. They're given $1 to run the facility, and they've got to spend so many 10 cents on a dollar for security. Well, if they don't have to spend 10 cents a dollar on security, they can now spend 95 cents on getting their bonuses by cleaning up the material out there. And so security will be given. It's the poor brother on the mission, and that's the way it's viewed all the way up and down the Department of Energy. But they prefer programmatic elements as far as, rather than doing security. Security is an overhead budget item. The less they can do and the less they spend on it, the more profit there is in other areas.
Amy, I'd also want to mention that it's not entirely the contractor's fault. The Department of Energy, for which they're working, lets them get away with it. The plans that the Department of Energy approves, and Ron, you can speak to this more directly, it's DOE, really, who is responsible for determining how much security should be there, and the contractor just essentially does what they're told.
That's correct. Some contractors are more conscientious. I worked for one at one of the sites, and that site determined they were going to have the best security and constantly met the mark without anybody telling them. Other ones do as little as possible, and in the case of Rocky Flats, that office for the Department of Energy was particularly in bed with the contractor, and they would let them slide on issue after issue after issue. And if anybody pointed out a problem like we just referred to the vehicle barrier on the fence, they just said, oh, no, that cannot be true, and they would basically fly cover for the contractor.
So these corporations, some of the most powerful in the United States, if they get good security ratings, they get bonuses?
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. yes. In fact, we were at one, again, I was with the special assistant, Peter Stockton, at the Livermore, California, and he pointed out that they were not even getting good ratings, but they were getting their full bonuses. And he asked the security director for the Department of Energy, why is that? And he said, well, I think they're trying hard. He said, and the second year? He said, well, I still thought they were trying hard. He said, and the third year? Well, I still, you know, think that they deserved it.
And which company runs Lawrence Livermore?
That was University of California.
Uh-huh. Well, what happened to you when you started pointing this out as the former lead analyst for the Department of Energy's
Well,
Office
actually,
of Safe
we, I was
Security.
Pushing it both from the bottom end, from the QA coming up to the normal channels within the department, and then working in parallel with the Special Assistant to the Secretary. So it was coming from Secretary Richardson down into the bureaucracy, too. And nothing was happening to either element on that. And again, that's borne out by presidential commissions that have said the Department of Energy is dysfunctional. And I sent a letter to what was called the Czar of Security, and I made that personal and confidential. He elected to turn it over to the IG. I knew how to spell Inspector General, and I thought, well, it's his job to try to clean this up within the purviews of his office, and he chose not to do it. Later on, when the administration changed and Secretary Abraham was named, I sent him a letter also and said, hey, you know, these are the problems with a new executive, and perhaps you're going to be able to address them. He had the letter answered by one of the people that I accused by name in his letter, saying there's no problem. Now, how dumb is that?
We've been able to track over time just an innumerable cases of the people who are coming forward, like Ron Tim, with the problem are the ones who lose their jobs, get their contracts canceled, have their security clearances pulled, while the people who are responsible for security at these facilities continue to rise in the bureaucracy or leave the bureaucracy and go to work for the contractor.
Yes.
Ronald Tim, how exactly were you retaliated against?
They told us to stop work on all our tasks. We had just been awarded we had previously been part of a 5-year contract that had been providing our services for analytical reasons. We had just been awarded another one a year ago last August, and in December they told us to stop work on all parts of the contract.
Did you lose your job?
Yes. I'm in the process of losing my corporation. There was $850,000 in contracts on the table that were just taken summarily off the table.
So what are you doing about this now, and can you sue?
With Danielle and Pogo, we are now, in fact, why don't you explain that, Danielle, since you're closer to it even than I am right now.
Well, Mr. Tim is in an unusual case. As you know, bureaucracies are terrible to go through. There's an office that takes whistleblower complaints from contractors, and they're currently saying, well, because he was retaliated against by the Department of Energy rather than the prime contractor, they're claiming that he may not have whistleblower protections, so we're challenging that.
And, of course, this case is bigger than you, Ronald Tim, because you're talking about the safety and security of the population that lives near these plants.
That's right. It is the public, and government has said this is a matter of societal interest, and they have, in fact, have made that declaration. All I'm doing basically is reporting back the lack of implementing their own rules. If they're prepared to take the risk and say we understand the problem, or if the president or the secretary of energy says I understand I'm at more risk than the rules will call for, I'd be more than happy to say, then you understand the job, it's your responsibility, and I've done my job at that point. But no one has ever made that assertion. They've all lied about what the status of security is, and therefore they go saying, well, it's not as bad as you say it is. And if it was just me, I'd say I'm wrong, but my job is to check, cross-check, and triple-check to make sure that these results are valid, and we've done that every single time. And like I said, it's not just myself, but it was a diverse group of over 20 people. And as Danielle said, that's why 12 people as whistleblowers now have come forward and been working with us since January of this year.
If people want to get in touch with the Project on Government Oversight, Danielle Bryan, where can they call or go on the web?
Well, we're at www.pogo.org, and our phone number is 202-347-1122.
And can people get a hold of this report? We didn't find it on your website or even see a press
release
for it.
No, that's right. We were very confused, to be honest, how to handle this, given the extremely alarming nature of the findings that we've had. So we'd originally worked, we briefed the National Security Council and the Pentagon, and Congressman Shays has now initiated an investigation, and we had not actually been working with frightening the public, really. We were working with trying to get the policymakers to do what they should. So we are not releasing it to the public simply because we're trying to be as responsible as we can.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us and sharing it with our listening audience around the country and the world. Daniel Bryan with POGO, Project on Government Oversight. Ronald Tim, former lead analyst for the Department of Energy's Office of Safeguards and Security. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to speak with a chemist who left Lawrence Livermore and Los Alamos Labs and is now talking about leaving the United States. We're also going to be joined by a librarian at the UCLA Research Library who was suspended without pay for sending out an email that is critical of U.S. foreign policy. Stay with us.
Them that's got shall have, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Yes, the strong gets more while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grade. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. That's got his own.
You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, and the smell is still very bad as we broadcast just blocks from where the World Trade Center once stood. The fire still burns. That's not a metaphor. It is true. There are major fires underneath, and when beams are brought up, you'll see plumes of smoke that cloud out the whole area. We are at a firehouse blocks from there, and the smell is very strong. The police checkpoints still remain at the end of our block as they stop vans and trucks that try to make their way down to this area. One day after the September 11th attacks, a librarian at the UCLA Research Library sent out a patriotic mass email to her coworkers, citing a 1973 speech written by Gordon Sinclair titled America, the Good Neighbor. Johnny Hargis, who works in the same department of the library, sent out a mass email response saying that the U.S. isn't such a good neighbor since it supports apartheid-like policies in Israel. He ended his email with the words, "So who are the terrorists anyway?" Library administrators got a hold of Hargis' response and said it violated library policy prohibiting unsolicited messages that contain political or religious messages to be sent to department lists. Hargis was suspended without pay from September 17th to the 21st, though the worker who sent the first mass email has not been subjected to any disciplinary action. We have a clip of Gordon Sinclair's speech recorded in 1973 that the first emailer sent around at the height of the anti-U.S. sentiment during the Vietnam War. This is Gordon Sinclair back then.
The United States dollar took another pounding on German, French, and British exchanges this morning, hitting the lowest point ever known in West Germany. It has declined there by 41% since 1971, and this Canadian thinks it's time to speak up for the Americans as the most generous and possibly the least appreciated people in all the world. When the Americans get out of this bind, as they will, who could blame them if they said to hell with the rest of the world? Let somebody else buy the bonds. Let somebody else build or repair foreign dams or design foreign buildings that won't shake apart in earthquakes. When the railways of France and Germany and India were breaking down through age, it was the Americans who rebuilt them. When the Pennsylvania Railroad and the New York Central went broke, nobody loaned them an old caboose. Both of them are still broke. I can name to you 5,000 times when the Americans raced to the help of other people in trouble. Can you name to me even one time when someone else raced to the Americans in trouble? I don't think there was outside help even during the San Francisco earthquake. Our neighbors have faced it alone, and I'm one Canadian who is damn tired of hearing them kicked around. They'll come out of this thing with their flag high, and when they do, they're entitled to thumb their noses at the lands that are gloating over their present troubles. I hope Canada is not one of these.
And that was Gordon Sinclair from 1973 in Toronto, America, the Good Neighbor. Again, a transcript of this was sent out by email at the UCLA Research Library. And a second person who works at the library, Johnny Hargis, responded. He was then suspended. The Coalition of Union Employees is a union that's filed a grievance with UCLA on behalf of Johnny Hargis. We're joined now by Johnny Hargis. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us.
I found the organ a nice touch on the on the piece you just played.
The head of the library department told you that your message, quote, demonstrated a lack of sensitivity that went beyond incivility and became harassment, contributing to a hostile and threatening environment. What exactly did you say in your email?
Well, sure. There's another point you had mentioned I would like to touch upon, too, is the reference they're making to a policy on email, of course, and let's talk about that because that is not mentioned in my suspension notice, and that's critical. Anyway, I'll be glad to read to you my fairly brief response I had to that email. And so I started out, "A response is called for here lest we gloat in self-righteousness. This is all well and good, but avoids the fact that U.S. taxpayers fund and arm an apartheid state called Israel, which is responsible for untold thousands upon thousands of deaths of Muslim, Palestinian children and civilians, contrary to international law. America sends $5 billion every year to this brutal occupying nation of circa 5 to 6 million, parentheses, do the math per person each year, end parentheses, in spite of international law and dozens of UN resolutions demanding cessation of Israel's illegal practices, parentheses, I could name them, but the list is too long for this response, paragraph. In the 1980s, the U.S. supported the illegal Israeli invasion of Lebanon, which cost the lives of 20,000 non-combatant Muslim civilians. The U.S. is still bombing Iraq 10 years after the Gulf War, which I might add cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of non-combatant Muslim civilians. We call it collateral damage, except when it happens to us. People do remember, you know. So who are the terrorists anyway? That's what I sent. And for that, I was suspended. And the suspension notice is particularly interesting in the sense that it does not mention any violations of email policy. And what's particularly curious is the day that I was suspended, an email policy was sent around. And I can read that to you. It's very brief. And I think that's the one that you were perhaps referring to. Now, remember, this is the exact same day I was suspended. Notes that was came from the head of Library Information Systems. I'll leave her name out of it for now, which the LIS, Library Information Systems, is basically responsible for the computer operations within the library system at UCLA, which is a large library system. Okay, she said, please remind your staff that sending unsolicited emails containing political, religious, or even patriotic messages to groups such as units, departments, or other library lists is an unacceptable use of library email. This is true for messages which are original, forwarded, and responses to other messages. Recipients of these unsolicited email messages may have very different views and should not be subjected to what they may interpret as electronic harassment by their library staff members. While this is particularly important now during the national crisis, it is a general policy. Well, within that, we find two very revealing words. First of all, please remind your staff. There's no remind here. I have never seen this before. No one's ever seen this before. It was simply created on the same day that I was suspended. And you'll notice at the end it said it is a general policy. Well, perhaps that may be the case then at that moment, but no one has ever seen this before. In fact, the library email policy is quite liberal in many regards, and if you'll give me a second, I can bring up a section from the email policy that...
Well, let me go to Liza Goh, who is the union representative at the Coalition of Union Employees. So you have Johnny Hargis, who's been suspended without pay for a week.
Uh-huh.
What about, and I want to put this question to Liza, what about the person who sent out the first email making a political statement?
They
were not dealt with in any way or disciplined.
No, they were not. And as a matter of fact, it wasn't just Johnny who was responding to the email. There was a whole, you know, exchange of emails over this specific email. The thing is, though, that what the union seeks is that the rule be applied equally and fairly to everybody. And what the union seeks is that whatever freedoms and rights were accorded to the persons who used the email be accorded to Johnny Hargis. And basically, it's about his freedom also to speak. And so the union does not seek that people be fired for expressing their political opinions about the standard issues of the day. The union's view is that, you know, people have that freedom to voice their opinions. And we would not want to have anyone suspended or disciplined for doing such. It's protected speech.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. You're back at work, Johnny Hargis?
Oh, yes, I am. I have returned, and it's a very uncomfortable situation. I am shunned, I think is the old medieval practice.
And you guys are grieving this.
Have a grievance in the works.
Well, I'm rushing along because we have one last segment, but I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Johnny Hargis, who is now back as a research librarian at UCLA, and Liza Goh with the Union Coalition of Union Employees. Finally today, we go back to the theme of the program as we look at biological and nuclear weapons. Nuclear scientists that we have had on the air before, Andreas Toupadakis, after he resigned from his job at Lawrence Livermore Livermore National Lab, saying his conscience would not allow him to work for the development of nuclear weapons. Well, since then, he's been lecturing on peace and environmental issues at university and colleges. Now, in the wake of the September 11th attacks, he's made another, well, kind of resignation. He's talking about resigning from the U.S. altogether. Thank you for joining us, Andreas Tupadakis. Can you explain where you're going from here?
I'm going to a place that I will not feel my conscience to feel easier. I don't want to be a part of an institution paying taxes that I know my hands are going to be full of blood. This is not the America I was dreaming of 20 years ago when I came here as an immigrant, and I got married here and I have children. I have been here 20 years, more than 20 years in fact, and I have lived in 8 different states. I have taught in about 8 different colleges and universities, worked in industry and 2 nuclear labs. And all these 20 years I was struggling to be able to survive with walking with one face, and I found it almost impossible. I had to have 2 faces to be able to survive and have a paycheck, and this is the climax. What I see is happening today, seeing that this country, the United States, standing at the turning point and make the decisions that it's making, I have taken a very hard decision in my personal life to go back to my birthplace and live a very simple life in the land.
Where is that?
That is in Crete, Rethymno, Argyropolis specifically. It's a village near the ocean, about 20 minutes from the ocean and on the mountains.
And what is it that you most object to here?
The most thing that I object here is the foreign policy of this country, and also the domestic policy, but mainly the foreign policy. I cannot stand to see a small group of people from within almost 300 million people to really dominate and subject to such a fear and torture all these Americans and, in fact, the whole world. I cannot stand that.
And you were involved with making nuclear weapons both at Lawrence Livermore Lab and Los Alamos?
Well, not in Los Alamos. In Los Alamos, I was doing environmental work, and that kind of idea and belief and understanding I came to Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory to work with. And I found out that I was placed in a stockpile stewardship program, which was nothing else but maintaining and improving nuclear weapons. And when I found about that, I resigned. And since that time, I'm speaking around, but this is too much for me to bear. And I have tried to speak. I have not found a lot of response from the peace movement. I have to say that very loudly. There are a lot of beautiful people within the peace movement, and they have called me a friend, and they have been treated as such. But the organizations, the ones that have the resources, they have completely ignored the message, and I have not found absolutely any help. And I have ceased to ask for any help, and I find out that the only way I can really continue my message is to go back, have 2 goats and a few trees, and get very basic, simple life, not expecting from any organization to support me, my living, to be able to really continue write and speak the truth.
Andreas,
and that is a very sad situation to recognize.
Andreas Tupadakis, I want to thank you very much for being with us as we're out of time, but we do want to come back to you as we continue with the War and Peace Report. Resigned from his job at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, now will return home to Crete and leave the United States. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to email us, send us mail at mail@democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report, produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Sloan, Miranda Kennedy, Anthony Sloan, our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman from In Exile, from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Them that's got shall have. Them that's not shall have.
From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. The FBI announces it's launching a criminal investigation after a third anthrax case is found in Florida. We'll take a look at anthrax and where it has been tested in the United States, and we'll take a look at U.S. policy around biological weapons.
But unfortunately, we've become a little bit isolationist. We didn't seem to really care about the enforcement of biological weapons. And that was our attitude, I believe, up until September 11th.
The U.S. refused to develop the biological weapons protocol. The major TV networks cracked down on themselves to restrict their news coverage of Osama bin Laden and Afghanistan. UN officials warn of a humanitarian catastrophe, and anti-Arab and Muslim hate crimes continue to increase. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. Now the fire still burns. Taliban Ambassador Mullah Abdul Salam Zaif said yesterday as many as 100 people have been reported killed by U.S. bombing in a village in eastern Afghanistan near the city of Jalalabad. The U.S. pounded Afghanistan for the fifth straight day today. However, Mullah Zaif said the leader of the ruling Taliban, Mullah Muhammad Omar, is alive a day after a U.S. official told Reuters two of his close relatives had been killed in the first day of strikes on Sunday. All Afghans are his relatives, Zaif told a news conference. He said the death toll had earlier been put at more than 70, but had risen with 15 people killed when U.S. jets hit a mosque near Jalalabad overnight. The world's largest Islamic body expressed concern yesterday in Qatar at the prospect of civilian casualties in Afghanistan, but steered clear of condemning outright the U.S. strikes against the Taliban rulers sheltering Osama bin Laden. A communique issued at the end of an emergency meeting of foreign ministers of the Organization of the Islamic Conference, or OIC, said member countries representing 1.2 billion Muslims strongly condemned the September 11th attacks. The 56-nation OIC meeting in the Gulf state of Qatar said the conference expressed its rejection of the targeting of any Arab country under the pretext of combating terrorism. It also rejected aggression against any Islamic state, a phrase seen by delegates as referring to attacks on Afghan civilians. A senior Philippine official said yesterday the United States plans to send a sizable contingent of military advisors to the Philippines in the next few weeks to help it crack down on alleged terrorist groups suspected of having ties to Osama bin Laden. The official, Roilo Goles, the national security advisor, said the team would provide training, intelligence, and equipment to local troops, which have been battling a Muslim insurgency on the economically impoverished and politically disenfranchised southern island of Mindanao. American officials in Washington said on Tuesday they were considering possible military action in the Philippines, Indonesia, and Malaysia to target groups they say are linked to Osama bin Laden. The Senate yesterday paved the way for swift action on anti-terrorism legislation as early as today. The Senate agreed to allow votes on four amendments that Wisconsin Democratic Senator Russell Feingold wanted to offer the bill in an attempt to safeguard civil liberties. The House passed its version of the so-called Patriot Act last week, dramatically expanding police and federal authority in dealing with wiretaps, personal records, and searches of property. Between 17 and 30 people were killed yesterday in southwestern Colombia by right-wing paramilitaries, this according to witnesses and survivors. The commander of Colombia's armed forces said 17 people were confirmed dead in two attacks in the southwestern town of Buga on Wednesday, but other reports placed the number of dead as high as 30. Authorities identified the attackers as members of the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia paramilitary group, which has extensive links to the U.S.-backed Colombian armed forces. And the U.S. government announced it would appeal a World Trade Organization ruling that its export tax breaks for U.S. companies flout free trade rules. and three American academics, including an outspoken former chief economist of the World Bank, today won the Nobel Prize for Economics. Joseph Stiglitz, one of those awarded, was chief economist of the World Bank, the International Development Agency, from 1997 to 99, and was a critic of some of the institution's policies while there. After his departure, he publicly aired his disagreements with the bank and its sister institution, the International Monetary Fund, criticizing them for their lack of transparency, undemocratic practices, and failure to improve the condition of the world's poor. And finally, the five major television news organizations reached a joint agreement yesterday to follow the suggestion of the White House and abridge any future videotape statements from Osama bin Laden. We'll talk more about that in a minute.
Let's take a call from Montreal. It's Joe. You're on the air.
Yeah. Tell me what's the use of PhDs for ICBMs if your politics are throwbacks to the Roman Colosseum. And when you leave the study just to seek a little heat, how you gonna tell a good guy from a villain? It turns out your education was so vague and incomplete that you can't even tell anthrax from penicillin. Are they so clever? They're not so clever. Just ask the population of Sudan. The smartest bomb of all would never even fall, would stay up in the air like Peter Pan.
I won't blow up.
Well, okay, Mr. MX, with your staggering IQ, why don't you tell us what you'd do if you only had your choice?
Well, I'd Bubba Bodell, Greg, Takamina, Ron, Con, Bron, Tonneron, Tuon, Fun. That wasn't an explosion. I was quoting from James Joyce.
The Prince Mishkin's Shiny Round Object. In the next segment, we'll be taking a look at anthrax. But first, we're going to take a look at media coverage of the bombing of Afghanistan. We are joined by Danny Schechter, the news dissector. He has been doing a daily column in his website called mediachannel.org. As I just said, the five major television news organizations reached a joint agreement yesterday to follow the suggestion of the White House and abridge any future videotape statements from Osama bin Laden or his followers to remove language the government considers inflammatory. The decision's the first time in memory that the networks had agreed to a joint arrangement to limit their prospective news coverage. It was described by one network executive as a patriotic decision that grew out of a conference call between the nation's top television news executives and the White House National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice yesterday morning. The executive said they would broadcast only short parts of any tape issued by al-Qaeda and would eliminate any passages containing flowery rhetoric urging violence against Americans. They agreed to accompany the tapes with reports providing what they called appropriate context. The White House move coincides with a clampdown on release of information. The Pentagon is stopping their daily briefings and going to sessions something like twice a week. Danny Schechter, your response to this national conference call of news executives yesterday?
Well, first of all, there's some context missing from the reporting. I mean, for several days prior to all this, Al Jazeera, the Qatar-based satellite television station, which has been broadcasting coverage from all sides in this conflict, there were attempts to try to get the government of Qatar to lean on them and their independence to actually curtail their coverage and stop their coverage. So when that failed, or seemed to fail, this seemed to be the next in the chain of, you know, various responses to try to limit information that the United States government doesn't like. Now, the grounds they're citing is that there might be secret codes or coded messages in these statements. One reference was made to a statement that Osama bin Laden made, a reference to the bombing of Japan, Hiroshima, as one of the crimes of the West. And this was cited apparently by an unnamed source, as one reason that they were surprised to have Japan mentioned and fear that that might be actually a message to people in Japan. But by and large, they have not revealed the grounds for doing this. The network response has actually been different from network to network. I'm told that I spoke with Radio New Zealand this morning, and they said that the Murdoch stations there have said they will not run any of these videos. CNN said they will review the videos. ABC News said they will only show stills, eliminate all Arabic voices, and replace them with English voices summarizing what's being said or the text of what's being said. So the different networks are responding in a different way. The networks basically say this is not an attempt by the government to censor them. Critics look at it and see it as a form of censorship, as part of a pattern of information management, which we've seen pretty dramatic. And there has been one coded reference that was revealed, yesterday and appears in the New York Post today as Osama bin Laden's Muppet State, apparently the appearance of a symbol of Bert from Sesame Street in the background of Osama bin Laden posters that are being used. Apparently this was downloaded off of a website, added to the poster of Osama bin Laden. There's been sort of an effort by, I think, satirists in Canada goofing on Bert as being an evil force in the world, evil Bert. And now evil Bert's image is actually on the same picture of Osama bin Laden, a big poster. Sesame Street has reacted with indignation. And it may be that the lawyers for Sesame Street will get to Osama bin Laden before the U.S. military to enforce intellectual property claims. At any rate, that's one of many bizarre turns in this whole story. But what's not bizarre is dramatic information management, including a downplaying of the humanitarian crisis, which is taking place inside Afghanistan with millions of people at risk of starvation and famine. The head of Medicine Without Frontiers, Doctors Without Borders, testified before Congress yesterday. At the same time as that testimony was being played on C-SPAN, up the dial, the Comedy Channel was making fun of the food drops by the military, suggesting that they should be serving fondue to the refugees rather than these meals ready to eat, so-called MREs. But the point was, what the NGOs were pointing out was that military forces should not be delivering humanitarian food, because what this does is it basically suggests that all the humanitarian aid workers there who've been there for months in Afghanistan are actually appendages of the military, and they're very concerned about that. And they also pointed out that many of these meals are being dropped in areas that have been heavily mined with landmines. So the food would be totally inaccessible. The food drop is completely ineffective.
Or if kids or adults go for that food, they could be blown up by the landmines.
Well, precisely. So the whole question has to be asked, is this simply a PR effort to sort of manicure the bombing policy? Last night on Nightline, at the very end of the broadcast, John McQuethy, who people, when I worked at ABC, used to refer to him as General McQuethy, as being, the Pentagon correspondent of ABC, was asked by Ted Koppel, "By the way, John, is there any information about civilian casualties?" And he said that the military has no way of knowing what the civilian casualties might be in Afghanistan. Quote, none. And that was from ABC News, and they didn't seem to be probing that too deeply. So acceptance of Pentagon claims and Pentagon formulations seems to be one of the dominant motifs of the coverage, and this type of coverage is upsetting people all over the world, and
Well, we are also joined, Annie Schechter, by George Monbiot, who is a columnist for the British newspaper The Guardian, and he has a piece called Genocide or Peace, which begins, "We can feed the starving in Afghanistan or mount a military campaign. We can't do both." George Monbiot, it's good to have you with us. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, we have only 3.5 weeks now before winter sets in Afghanistan. And when winter sets in, it's simply impossible to distribute food there. You get snow up to your neck. You can't move trucks around. You can't fly planes in. You're simply not going to be able to get food to the 7.5 million people that the UN now estimates are in very serious danger of starvation. And so we have to get in nearly 5 months' worth of food in the next 3.5 weeks, and that means either 21,000 lorries or 19,000 Hercules transport planes. And that's simply impossible while there's military action going on. You can't do both in this very, very limited window of opportunity that there is before the winter closes in. And so by taking the option to do a military operation with a bit of a humanitarian operation tacked onto the back of it, we've actually taken the option not to do an effective humanitarian operation. And that's going to be a disaster, I'm afraid, for the people of Afghanistan. And we could see hundreds of thousands, possibly even millions of people starving to death over the winter because we haven't been able to get the food in on time.
I also wanted to get your reaction to what Danny was just talking about, which was the news decision of American news executives not to run the kind of thing that we saw on Sunday, which was the Bush speech and then Osama bin Laden, a videotape of him that was first aired on Al Jazeera Network. Qatar cited freedom of the press Wednesday in its defense of the satellite TV station against U.S. charges of inflammatory rhetoric in its coverage of the Afghan crisis. And media mogul Rupert Murdoch said today his TV networks will refuse to screen videotape footage of Osama bin Laden if there is concern it contains coded messages to his followers. What has been the response in Britain, and what is BBC and other networks doing in Europe?
Well, the BBC's coverage hasn't been as full as it should be. I'm not sure what their particular decision regarding the bin Laden videos are concerned, though I understand that they will be limiting them in some way. But there is a profound irony here, I think. Those of us who have questioned U.S. foreign policy and defense policy in Afghanistan have rather absurdly been accused of being anti-American. But I think it's profoundly anti-American to start censoring news output and to refuse to cover certain aspects of what's going on, and particularly the humanitarian aspect. It's also, I think, profoundly anti-American to start identifying peaceful campaign groups as potential terrorists, as some people in the FBI have done, groups such as Greenpeace or Reclaim the Streets, for example. And yesterday we spoke
with Women in Black, who are being investigated.
You know, George's point here is really well taken, but there's another dimension to this that really we have to think about. This is not a conflict simply between George Bush on the one hand, the U.S. position, and bin Laden on the other hand. There are other points of view, many of them expressed on programs like this, many of them expressed in newspapers like The Guardian, which we've been covering regularly in George's work on MediaChannel.org. There are a lot of other voices that are being eliminated from the media. There's a big crime of omission here, which is as important as the crime of commission, that is to say, singling out certain points of view and eliminating them. A lot of points of view are being screened out here, and other voices are not being heard. And this morning I watched CNN, and I watched the report where, you know, simply a man had a map talking about the military campaign, no reference to the starvation in Afghanistan, no reference to civilians, almost as if he was a military briefer. And a journalist shouldn't be playing that role. So that's the deeper problem with the media coverage. And I think George and his colleagues at The Guardian should be commended for their consistent work that you do not see in the American press.
Let's listen just for a moment to some of that media coverage.
The Point, tracking the terrorists, the world's most wanted.
We don't know what he looks like. We don't really know where he is.
The renewed hunt for an elusive and deadly mystery man. The signs and meanings that may go deeper than what appears on the screen.
A covert war with special forces combat troops on the ground.
Tonight, a fourth night of military strikes against targets in Afghanistan, some of the heaviest action so far.
The White House is worried about coded messages buried in Osama bin Laden's videotape diatribes, and that we may inadvertently pass those messages on to covert cells watching our programs here in the United States.
Is the real concern here that the White House is afraid bin Laden might actually be getting through to some Americans?
Some of the sounds of the corporate media's coverage of the war in Afghanistan. George Monbiot, you write, if Osama bin Laden did not exist, it would be necessary to invent him.
Yes, I think there's for a long time been a symbiotic relationship between terrorists and the military-industrial complex on both sides of the Atlantic. This isn't by any means confined to the United States. Britain's just as much involved in this. And what I mean by that is that the two sides desperately need each other. The terrorism, like the horrendous terrorism that we saw on September the 11th, is the justification for vast military spending. Whereas at the same time, the likes of Osama bin Laden, they desperately want a military response. And I feel that in some respects the West has walked into a trap which he's set, where he's trying to boost his campaign enormously by precipitating this great military backlash and making him into a far more important man than he was before. This demonization, this monstering of bin Laden, creates the momentum which he's been seeking. And so I think in subtle ways these two sides have existed, coexisted for a long time and have built up each other's power. And as a result, we have a very dangerous situation indeed. Bin Laden has become this iconic cult figure to many Muslim fundamentalists, or even people who are not Muslims but are angry and resentful towards some of the powerful nations in the world. And at the same time, the military-industrial complex has been able to increase its grip on culture, on sensibilities, on the media, on both sides of the Atlantic. And that leads the world a very unstable and dangerous place.
George, just one other point on this. And, you know, we at MediaChannel.org would call on all of your listeners to start looking at the not-so-coded messages in the American media and see what that's signaling. One of the deeper problems here, and I would recommend a book called Jihad versus McWorld by Ben Barber, which shows that fundamentalist forces that are reacting to America are also reacting to a free market fundamentalism, that we have a sort of jihad versus jihad going on here, and that both sides are equally uncomfortable with democracy, the name of this program, and equally determined to sort of snuff it out. One wants a theocracy, the other wants a military-industrial combination dominating everything. And I think we have to look carefully at this, that there is another way of viewing this without sort of choosing sides between Bush or bin Laden. And I think there's a need here, particularly for folks on the left, people who are progressive, to begin to look at this in new ways with a deeper level of analysis and to look at the role that the media is playing. And in that respect, I have to say, coming here today into this firehouse and watching Amy and this team work, that this is really what independent media is and could be doing. And I think your work is fantastic, and we support it totally. And we hope that your listeners will as well, to keep this program and its voices alive in the spectrum of debate in America.
Well, in our next segment, talking about these voices, we're going to talk about bioterror. We're going to talk about bioweapons developed here in the United States and the experiments that have been done in this country, not by foreign terrorists, but by U.S. government officials, of spraying populations with bioweapons that people were not aware they were the victims of. And we're going to hear about the increase in hate attacks against Arab Americans and Muslims. I got in a cab last night, and I asked the taxi driver how he was doing. It was around 11:30, and he said he was very shaky because he'd been attacked 15 minutes before. We'll hear from him as well. Danny Schechter, thank you very much for being here, bringing in your new book called News Dissector, Passions, Pieces, and Polemics, 1960 to 2000. You can see his work at MediaChannel.org, and you can also see George Monbiot's work there, the columnist for The Guardian newspaper in Britain. Thank you for joining us, and we'll have you back again soon.
Thanks very much, Amy. Good luck to you.
You are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report as we continue with our two-hour daily coverage in this unprecedented collaboration between various public media on the internet, broadcasting on independent media sites and WBIX.org, as well as WebActive.com, on cable access stations, public access TV stations around the country. Here in New York, we're on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, Channel 34, Monday through Wednesday, and 56, Thursday and Friday. You can also see us on Dish Network, Free Speech TV's 24-hour channel there at channel 9415. That's 9415, and you can see us on CUNY TV as well, and of course on the Pacifica affiliate stations, community radio stations around the country, as well as Pacifica station KPFA. And if you are a listener on other Pacifica stations, tell them that they too could be running Democracy Now! Again. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. If you also want to see George Monbiot's columns, you can go to www.monbiot, M-O-N, as in Nancy, M-O-N-B-I-O-T, .com, and all this information you can get at democracynow.org. Stay with us.
It's bad, you know.
You're listening to the War and Peace Report, Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Federal officials yesterday announced they've launched a criminal investigation into the source of anthrax contamination after learning a third worker at a newspaper office was exposed. The bacteria has already killed one man and put a co-worker in the hospital. Also yesterday, unnamed sources close to the FBI said the unusual characteristics of the particular anthrax bacteria that killed the man in Florida suggest it was produced in a laboratory and that it may have been produced at an unnamed lab in Ames, Iowa. But the source said the tests were still inconclusive. Governor Tom Vilsack of Iowa said there was no confirmation of any connection between Iowa and the cases in Florida, while announcing that officials have pinpointed the location of anthrax at locations around Iowa and ordered national security protections for those sites, including Iowa State Patrol troopers, the National Guard, and local police. The dean of the Iowa State University College of Veterinary Medicine insisted, "I can almost assure you it doesn't have any direct connection to Iowa." The CDC has said it has virtually ruled out environmental causes as the source, although the anthrax that is now cropping up in Florida is being called the Ames strain for Ames, Iowa. We're joined by two people. Gene Gilliman is senior fellow at MIT's Security Studies Program, author of Anthrax, The Investigation of a Deadly Outbreak. And Dr. Leonard Cole teaches political science at Rutgers. His most recent book is The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. Dr. Gilliman, let's begin with you. Can you tell us, first of all, what is this Ames strain of anthrax that they're talking about?
Well, I think we have to back off right away about the identification of the strain. I think it's inconclusive at the moment. The Ames strain is a very, within the community that knows anthrax, it's a very well-known strain identified, I think it was in the late 1940s at University of Iowa. And but I don't think it's really clear right now. I mean, my sources tell me that they're still looking around to find out exactly what the strain might be. You know, there are dozens of strains of anthrax, so you can't just leap for the one. And finding out which one it is a rather delicate process.
Explain how anthrax works.
Well, first of all, there's something that's crept into the press in the last couple of days, which is inaccurate, and that is that anthrax is manufactured in any way. It's a bacterium. It can be grown. Its sources are always natural, as far as is practically known in the world. So it can be found in any continent in the world as anthrax, and it is associated with grazing animals. It's an ancient, ancient disease, but I do think we have to get away from this idea of manufacture. It can be, from nature. Somebody obviously got a hold of some particular source of it, and I think eventually they'll track it down.
Can you talk about the history of the development of U.S. bioweapons?
The United States got into the research and development and manufacture of the munitions for anthrax and other biological weapons during World War II. We were asked to get engaged by the Brits and the Canadians, who were already engaged in the war, and then we followed on and developed the program. And after World War II, we kept that program going. It was a kind of side venture that went along with all of our weapons development during the Cold War, up until 1969, when President Nixon decided to renounce biological weapons. The program had not been reviewed for a long time. People were doing their work at these scattered laboratories. He looked at it and basically made the decision, as he put it, that mankind already had in its hands the seeds, you know, too many seeds of its own destruction. And so in 1969, he renounced biological weapons. We got out of the business of offensive biological weapons.
What are the tests that the U.S. did around anthrax?
Well, they had a very aggressive program in terms of trying to figure out how to use biological weapons against the former Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was considered our arch enemy during the Cold War, so they had simulated tests, for example, to see how they might attack a Soviet city with deadly aerosols or with aerosols that would at least sicken people. And they did simulated tests over major American cities.
Dr. Leonard Cole, you've written extensively about these U.S. tests around biological warfare in your book, The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. Can you give us some examples of these, and were any using anthrax that you covered?
Well, there were many, many tests over populated areas with simulants of anthrax, that is, other bacteria that carried several of the same characteristics except their high lethality. They were very, very relatively innocuous bacteria. Anthrax was definitely used in open-air tests over water areas. Actually, several tests involved spraying from low-flying airplanes at ships, and the ships had many animal species on them to see what the effects might be. We also had open-air tests at some locations in the United States in largely unpopulated areas, Dugway Proving Ground in Utah, in which anthrax and other lethal materials were tested outdoors.
These tests that were conducted, of course, top secret, I think surprise a lot of people. And you've written extensively not only about anthrax, Dr. Cole, but a lot of these top secret U.S. Army tests that were conducted on the U.S. population. Can you give examples of others?
Well, when you speak of tests on the population, again, we're not talking about anthrax. And we're not talking about any, let me backtrack a little bit. Anthrax was not used against populations, but other potential biological warfare agents, those that cause tularemia and Q fever, which are less likely to kill and rather easily controlled even after infection with antibiotics, though if one is untreated, a person can become very, very ill. Those were sent off and released and exposed to people who were presumably volunteers. That is, they had supposedly informed consent. We're not sure to this day how much they really knew about what they were getting exposed to. They were largely conscientious objectors during the time of the draft, the military draft. These people did not want to serve in any military capacity, so they had a deferment from actual military service and became volunteer subjects. These materials were released. It was very clear that to the extent that Q fever and tularemia could be released and manufactured, that is, the organisms that caused that, they were effective in harming these people, although they were given antibiotics, the people were soon after. But we had numerous tests. Actually, what happened in 1968 pretty much closed down the open-air tests with highly lethal materials. And paradoxically, it was not a biological agent that was involved. It was something called VX, which is a highly toxic nerve agent. That was released over Dugway Proving Ground in Utah, and apparently wind shifts carried this some 20 miles away from the base. And within 24 hours, some 6,000 sheep and other livestock just dropped dead. Several ranchers in the area also became quite ill. It was at that point that the military made a decision that they ought to be a lot more cautious about what they're spreading through the air.
You also write about the tests that were conducted in the New York subways, certainly of grave concern today. A lot of people are afraid that that could be the site of an attack, you know, not to engage in hype or anything like that. But, of course, it's where large masses of population are.
Well, that's true. As a matter of fact, during the 1950s and 60s, the Army conducted 239 tests that it acknowledged in populated areas, and the variety of releases was probably as broad as your imagination can let it go. There were materials sprayed from the coast of San Francisco, that is, from a slow-moving ship up and down the coast, the bay, and bacteria and chemical particles were released over the Bay Area population. In the cities of St. Louis and Minneapolis, slow-moving vehicles with phony exhaust pipes were releasing materials. Again, although they were bacteria and chemicals, they were not the highly toxic type that would be used in a, presumably as a biological weapon. And then, as you suggest, in the New York City subway system in 1966, bacteria were packed into light bulbs, and people, agents working for the government, would just drop a light bulb on the tracks of a subway train as it was coming in, on the tracks, I should say, before a subway train came into the terminal, and as the train came in, it whooshed up some gusts, and the materials that had been dropped onto the track started clearly disseminating and dispersing throughout the subway terminal. And it was estimated that more than half of the population that was riding the subways could conceivably have become ill had these test bacteria been real biological agents.
And when was it exposed that this was done, throwing black light bulbs onto the subways?
Well, the 1950s and 60s was the top secret program that nobody knew about except those who were on the inside in the government. It was only in the late 1970s that we first learned that there were any biological warfare tests done over populated areas. And it wasn't, again, until the late 70s, early 80s, and then when I started writing more about it, and ultimately wrote a book about the Army's germ warfare tests, I guess we got much more information out by 1988, when the book first appeared, than had been known previously.
We're talking to Leonard Cole. He is author of the book, The 11th Plague, Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare, also on the line with us from MIT, Dr. Gene Gilman, senior fellow at the Security Studies Program there and author of Anthrax, The Investigation of a Deadly Outbreak. Dr. Gilman, how does anthrax actually work in the body? What does it affect?
Well, the anthrax we're talking about of late is called inhalation or inhalational anthrax. And in order to get that, you have to breathe very deeply tens of thousands of spores that would go very, very deep into the lung. And those spores, if your immune system is not working well, will germinate and produce a bacteria. And the bacteria then produces a toxin, and it's the toxin that actually is most lethal. It kills people in 80 to 90% of the cases which become infected.
We know about Plum Island today, off the coast of Long Island, where biological tests are being done. But what about the Ames, Iowa facility?
Well, we're talking really about the University of Iowa in Ames, and the people in charge there have been very emphatic that they have nothing to do with anthrax itself, and certainly nothing to do with this particular outbreak or this one particular case of the man who died, Mr. Stevens. So I think they're right. It just turns out that, you know, when an anthrax strain is isolated, it may pick up the name of the place where that was done. And that's why it's referred to as the Ames strain. It's very well known. There's a whole typology of anthrax strains, and again, there are dozens of them. They occur worldwide.
Dr. Cole, can you also comment on that?
Yeah, I would like to back up just one slight bit. When Dr. Gilman appropriately said that we don't formally, technically, manufacture anthrax strains, we certainly can alter them. There can be genetic engineering done in a laboratory, which could conceivably develop a strain that would have been quite unique and not recognizable by way of comparison with strains that are known. And we do have something on the order of 1,000 to 1,200 known anthrax strains, although only a few hundred of them have been carefully identified with what's called DNA fingerprinting. So we really are up in the air about the nature at this point, the nature and precise characteristics of the strain that was used in the Florida case.
In terms of the U.S.-Soviet bioweapons sort of contest, who could develop more faster, it's interesting that the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, has said that this so-called war on terrorism, we should think about it in the same way we thought about the Cold War, and that it could go on for years. I was wondering, Dr. Gilman, if you could elaborate more on the tests that were done, as you talk about the tests over U.S. cities for use on Soviet cities, I mean, for possible use. Of course, this was decades ago.
Yes, this was a long time ago, and I think we have to make a distinction between then and now. The United States government is out of the business of offensive biological weapons and anything to do with their planning, so I don't think we want to go too far down in that direction. Tests that were done, there was one set of tests called the St. Joe Project, which was to spray simulants again over a Canadian city and then two American cities. But I think that the issue here about why we're all so afraid, I think we are raising very important questions about what is the government doing. And we want vigilance, from the government. We don't want to go back to these old scenarios of how they disregarded the safety of citizens. And one of the issues, I think, that really has to come up eventually when we're over the terroristic phase is what are we doing about the Biological Weapons Convention? The United States basically walked away from the treaty that bans biological weapons, and that is not a good thing. We don't want that.
Can you explain that further? I don't think a lot of people remember that. That's certainly important to bring up in this context.
Well, in 1972, the United States, the UK, and the USSR got together and formulated a treaty which would make biological weapons illegal worldwide. And that treaty came into force in 1975. The problem with the treaty is it's never really had a good enforcement program. That is, inspecting facilities, getting people to declare facilities, was left up to everybody's goodwill. And over the last 6 years, we have been working, the United States was working with other countries that are party to the treaty to get into place inspection teams and solid declarations and even sanctions, punishments of people who would dare to manufacture biological weapons, get into the business, or if they had been in the business or were in the business. And in last July, unfortunately, the United States delegates got up and left the table saying they basically didn't really care about the Biological Weapons Treaty. I think it's time now to go back to the table and say, we care a lot about biological weapons. We really want them eliminated from the globe, and we have to go at it in every way we can. Criminalize their use, impose sanctions, make inspections mandatory. We have to do that. And we didn't do it, actually. We backed away from the table in part because the American pharmaceutical industry didn't want any inspections of their production facilities. They said they just weren't going to be party to it.
So the U.S. has not signed on to a bioweapons accord and ban because of the corporate influence of the U.S. drug industry wanting to protect proprietary information, they said?
We are signatories. We did sign on to the treaty. We formulated the treaty. We signed on to the treaty. But when it came down to what we call the protocol, that is how you actually enforce the treaty, how you actually make it work and, get inspection teams together and how you work that out internationally, as we do for chemical weapons. We have a very effective chemical weapons ban that the United States took very strong leadership in creating. George Bush the first George Bush, President Bush, in 1993, was a major leader in banning chemical weapons. But unfortunately, we've become a little bit isolationist. We didn't seem to really care about the enforcement of biological weapons, and that was our attitude, I believe, up until September 11th. And I think that attitude has really changed, and I think that you know, ordinary people have to start asking their government, what are you doing about biological weapons and getting them off the face of the globe?
Dr. Leonard Cole, I know you have to go. Just a last response is you were writing your book. Now it's a few years later. As you hear these stories in Florida, what it makes you think, and also because we have a large Bay Area in San Francisco, Berkeley area audience, one of the studies that you looked at of secret U.S. Army experiments were conducted in San Francisco Bay. Is that right?
Yes. Well, I had mentioned briefly before that bacteria called Serratia marcescens and another called Bacillus subtilis were sprayed in 1951 and 50 during tests off the coast of San Francisco, and the Army estimated that most of the people in San Francisco would have become infected had these bacteria become, if they were really serious biological agents. As it was, there was a suspicious outbreak of Serratia marcescens infections in a hospital in San Francisco. Several people came down with infection, one of whom died. The Army said that the strain of Serratia marcescens was different from the one that they used. There was a court trial on that 30 years after the fact, when one of the people who died, the person who died, whose relatives then later on learned about all of this and brought the suit to federal court, they lost, in part because it's very difficult to establish a cause and effect 30 years after the fact. I would say, especially about the Florida case, it does give me a good deal of concern. Not that I'm expecting a mass outbreak of anthrax infections down there, but this was the first, apparently first, known use of an anthrax bacteria or any biological agent aimed at killing people in the United States. There might have been efforts in the past that we don't know about.
Leonard Cole, Gene Gilliman, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, and then we're going to be talking about the escalation of hate crimes in this country. But I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Leonard Cole teaches political science at Rutgers University in New Jersey. His most recent book is The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. Dr. Gene Gilliman is a senior fellow at MIT's Security Studies Program and author of Anthrax, The Investigation of a Deadly Outbreak. You are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
Why do we seem to vote to dig your holes? It's such a waste of a planet.
You are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we broadcast just blocks from the first Ground Zero. In the aftermath of the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, there are over 700 reports of hate crimes against Muslims and Arab Americans and those perceived to be of Middle Eastern descent. At least four homicides are being investigated as possible hate crimes. Arab American community groups who are tracking the attacks say they have not seen such a high number since the Gulf War 10 years ago. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee in Washington says they've collected more reports of possible hate crimes than they've recorded in any of their previous books. On Monday, we reported on the latest death being investigated as a hate crime, the killing of Abdu Ali Ahmed, who was shot in his convenience store near Fresno, California, near Reedley. One week ago, Abdullah Nimer, a 53-year-old Palestinian-American salesman and father of six, was shot while doing his door-to-door clothing sales in South Central Los Angeles, a neighborhood he'd worked in for several years. Though the circumstances surrounding his killing remain unclear, the Council on American Islamic Relations says that given the current climate of hostility against Arab Americans, they urge the LAPD and FBI to investigate Nimer's death as a hate crime. And then there are the daily attacks, small or large, and however small, especially large in this climate, on people perceived to be the other. Last night, I got in a taxi cab around 11 o'clock, and I just asked the taxi driver how he was feeling. He said he was feeling very bad because he, too, had just been attacked some 30 minutes before. So I recorded what he had to say.
My name is Ihab al-Ashrafi. What happened? I'm a taxi driver, a guy from New Jersey driving a SUV. He caught me in a red light. All I did is just blow my horn, and all of a sudden I see him push a brake in front of me, and six of big muscles guys coming out start to curse me, and I didn't say anything like fault. It's not my fault. It's their fault. And they want to fight. All I did is just like I take off, and I find the police coming over. And he said that it's not a smart move to do this. You can't involve in six people fight. That's it.
Did they say anything to you?
I told you, they started to curse me. And they said, go back the way you're coming from. And they start to open the door and close it. They push me against the door, and one of them is jumping in the back of the car.
Ihab al-Shafi, just a New York taxi cab driver on his regular run, who was attacked by people who had no idea who he was, except that he looked like he was of Middle Eastern origin. In fact, he comes from Alexandria, Egypt. Well, from the attacks on someone like Ihab to what we were just talking about, the death of the man in South Central Los Angeles, which is now being considered whether it is a hate crime, Abdullah Nimer. We turn now to Raheed Faraj, who is with the Council on American Islamic Relations in Southern California. He attended Abdullah Nimer's funeral. We welcome you to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's good to have you with us. Well, first, can you tell us the latest on his case, this door-to-door salesman and father of six killed after he was going door-to-door selling clothes?
Certainly. Well, the death of Abdullah Nimer was really a sad tragedy for his family, as well as to the Muslim community and the Arab American community, Palestinian community, all over Southern California. It's an unfortunate incident, and we hope that it would never happen to anybody else, regardless of their background, ethnicity, or faith. As you mentioned earlier, Mr. Nimer has been extremely a well-liked person in the community, not only in his immediate community, but in the communities that he worked with as well. He was soft-spoken, generous, kind. These are some of the statements that the people who dealt with him in his many years of work came up with. Therefore, when he was killed, it was really a shock to the family and to the community. And he reported, actually, unfortunately, after the September attacks, on several occasions, that what we learned earlier, later from his wife, that he did receive several verbal threats and he was harassed. But he chose not to report this because he thought understood people on heightened emotions as a result of that.
But, Raheed Faraj, I wanted to ask you about the words of Daniel Pipes, the former State Department aide who runs the think tank Middle East Forum,
yeah,
that have been reported on in the media. In an interview with the Philadelphia Inquirer several days ago, Pipes cited the term Islamism, which he says resembles fascism and Marxism-Leninism. Then he said, many of them are peaceable in appearance, but they all must be considered potential terrorists.
Well, if Daniel Pipes said the statement that you just told me, I would consider it unfortunate to come from somebody who of his stature. It's really unfortunate. But I will turn it and say that, can we say the same thing about every single person who, if happened to commit a heinous crime from the Christian community or the Jewish community or the Buddhist community or the Hindu community or any other community, that we can label a whole community with such slogans? That's really unfortunate.
How are you documenting crimes right now in Southern California?
Well, we certainly document them by based on interviews that people, or basically reports that we receive from people from the local community, or some local organizations, not necessarily Muslim or Arab. We also, sometimes from the media, they get it before we get hold of the story. That's very much how we get our stories, and certainly we do our utmost to verify the authenticity of these stories as well.
And what do you recommend? How can people protect themselves, and how can communities that are not being targeted now help to protect communities that are?
Well, I believe it's very important at a difficult time like this to keep an open mind. We do appreciate certainly the president's remarks, and I think he was very quick to call upon all of us to be objective and not to rush to judgment, and to avoid the use of violence against any member of our community. And therefore, that I think, in my personal opinion, that this is the best approach that we can take at a difficult time like this. After all, we're all Americans. After all, this heinous crime attack, it's an attack on all of us. We are all here because we do love this country, because we want to be in this country and want to continue to serve.
Well, Raed Faraj, I want to thank you very much for being with us of the Council on American-Islamic Relations in Southern California, just returning from the funeral yesterday of Abdullah Nimer, a Palestinian-American killed in South Central Los Angeles. That does it for today's program. We'd very much like to hear your comments. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our engineer, and music maestro Errol Maitlands at WBIX.org, where the War and Peace Report can be heard live. You can also hear us at webactive.com. Thanks to Amy Pomerleau and Aaron Glantz and all the community at KPFA, also to Pacifica affiliate KFCF in Fresno. All the Pacifica affiliates, we are Pacifica. Special thanks to the New York Independent Media Center and our hosts at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno. We can now be heard in New York on WFMU 91.1 FM every evening at 7 p.m. Manhattan Neighborhood Network, channels 34 and 56 on Dish Network, Free Speech TV, channel 9415. We are broadcasting just blocks from where the World Trade Center towers once stood, and exiled from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the band and the fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.